Season's greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Today, I'm interviewing the world's foremost ski historian, Seth Mazija, who is president of the International Skiing History Association and the publisher of Skiing History since 2014 and its editor since 2002. He is perhaps best known for his 20 years of service at Ski from 1974 to 1993, mostly on the equipment beat, where he was a pillar of the ski media, and in those days, a very big deal. He segued from print to the cyber world when, between 1994 and 1996, he designed, built, and launched SkiNet.com, the first consumer website devoted to skiing. He capitalized on that experience with a three-year stint at Microsoft, followed by a year as director of internet strategy at IntraWest, giving him a close-up view of one of the biggest resort conglomerates of its day. Seth is also a Level 3 member of PSIA, logging long teaching stints at Squaw Valley, as it was then known, and 22 years at Vail Beaver Creek Ski Schools and Aspen Snowmass. He also saw the ski market from the equipment supplier side, serving as Alpine product manager at K2 during my tenure at Snow Country in 1993 through 1994. Currently, he serves as a marketing consultant for Wagner's Custom Skis, as he has since 2007. Off the ski grid, Seth has labored as the award-winning editor of Solar Today magazine and served as executive director of the American Solar Energy Society. He started alpine skiing on the glaciers above Chamonix during a climbing trip in 1968 and has lived and worked in ski towns like Steamboat Springs, Tahoe City, Truckee, Vail, and Snowmass. Seth, welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Jackson, thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Sometimes you're the only guy who understands what I have to say.
I'll take that as a compliment. Let's see if we can follow the hopscotch path of your early ski career. When did you first get on alpine skis?
I took a climbing trip to Europe in 1968 that was in the middle of my college career. I was a rock climber and I wanted to go to Chamonix and climb rocks, but it was a few months after the 1968 Grenoble Olympics and the French were just nuts about skiing. So everybody in town was up on the La Flégère snowfields running slalom gates in the corn snow when I got there in July. I let someone twist my arm and rented some skis and boots and went up there and rolled around in the corn snow for 3 or 4 days and really got hooked. I had done a little cross-country skiing when I was a kid, nothing serious, but more to the point, like most boys growing up in the Chicago suburbs, I had hockey skates and used them and I knew how to skate, and that put me in really good stead when I started skiing. And so I have to say, while I was 19 years old and I remember it acutely, in retrospect, I didn't have a real beginner phase. I was never at a loss to balance on my skis. And I always had a good instinct as to when to step onto the new ski and where to point it.
When did you get your first job in what we might call the ski trade?
Well, when I graduated from college in 1970, I was drafted and I talked fast and got myself conscientious objector status and went to work in a children's hospital in Cleveland. And Dick Bohr had the ski house, ski shop in Cleveland Heights, and he had a climbing and backpacking shop there in the summer. So I walked in and introduced myself and he hired me to help sell climbing equipment and help him put together his catalog. And I stayed on through the winter. So I was working at the hospital at night and working in the ski shop during the day. So this is 1970 to 1972. And over 2 winters, I learned to fit ski boots and sell skis and bindings and mount bindings and to tune skis. And in those days, we were still selling some wooden skis. So there was a fair amount of ski repair work. So that was my introduction to the sport. And after that, I went out to Colorado for a winter just to ski bum and fetched up at Stagecoach. It was their first winter open and they didn't have much in the way of customers. So the small staff had this 3-lift ski area all to ourselves and we made the best of it. I worked on trail crew and followed the patrol guys around and flipped burgers at lunchtime, did a little bit of everything on the hill. But mostly, I just followed the ski patrol guys around, and we skied a lot. We skied a lot of powder. We didn't have a lot of bumps because we didn't have a lot of traffic. We didn't have a lot of forest. I skied a lot of trees. That's how I really learned to ski.
So how did you learn the other necessary skill for your current profession, which was writing? How did you make the transition from stagecoach to the assignment desk at Ski Magazine?
I grew up as a writer and editor. I was editor of my high school paper. We won a bunch of national awards, the Evanstonian weekly newspaper. I had summer jobs editing textbooks at educational publishers. I also helped some non-English speaking doctoral candidates write their doctoral dissertations in fluid dynamics at the Illinois Institute of Technology. So while I was an English and history major, I also had a pretty good informal technical background in physics and engineering. And when I got to New York, I wound up, after a couple of false starts, I wound up as the technical editor, this is the equipment editor of Backpacker magazine, which was brand new at that time. I had a really good background for that. And I set up their product testing program. We were very successful. The magazine broke even in its first year of publication, which is absolutely unheard of. At one point, Times and Mirror magazines, which owned Ski, was thinking about buying Backpacker. So John Fry at Ski Magazine knew about me, and he needed somebody who could write about equipment. They had a couple of false starts in hiring equipment editors, guys who didn't work out for one reason or another. So I got a call at one point that changed my life. And I went over and I talked to John Fry and went to work for him in the summer of 1974. I was there for 20 years.
Quite a span. What was the biggest story in retrospect that you covered over that 20-year period?
Oh, I would have to say the Olympics, in particular the 1984 Olympics, when Americans won gold medals in downhill and slalom and giant slalom. That was the era of Billy Johnson and Phil and Steve Mayer and Debbie Armstrong and Kristen Cooper. And they all came home with medals. I think we won half of the Alpine medals going at that Olympics. Besides which, it was in Sarajevo, which was a fascinating cultural experience. And if you were perceptive, you could see the seeds of the Yugoslav Civil War that was coming in a few more years.
Switching themes, when you were in your glory years at Ski, and when I was in my glory years at Snow Country, we both were beneficiaries of some of the most elaborate press boondoggles
as
ever seen. And amazingly, we survived them, but in my case, just barely. In fact, you played part in resuscitating me. It turns out that 10 cognacs on the flight over was probably too many at some point. And that caused massive dehydration. And you had to take me out of the lunchroom where we were in Albertville.
Practically carried you on my back.
Exactly.
Out of the restaurant. And you're bigger than I am. So this was no small feat. And I practically carried you on my back out to the bus and got you started rehydrating.
Yes. Yeah. It turned out rehydration ultimately didn't take, as you'll discover when we conclude this little episode.
Yeah.
We were there so that Rossignol could show us a new factory that they built in Voiron. And the idea was to convince us in the U.S. media that the new inheritor of the 7SK and the 4SK, these iconic Rossignol slalom skis, were going to be now made as squirt skis in like a 90-second process instead of the much more elaborate process of building the ski by hand. Let's just say the idea did not take.
Yeah, that was the 4SV. I don't recall what the V stood for, but that ski was so overdamped that it was a submarine. It would go to the bottom of the snowpack. If you tried to ski it in powder, it would go to the bottom of the snowpack and stay there.
And what did we get for a ski day when we were there?
We went up to Teen, and they were having a World Cup race, but it was also snowing like jet stink. There was one delay after another on the World Cup race, and nobody wanted to hang around, and it was snowing like crazy, and we all wanted to be out powder skiing. The last thing you wanted to do was ski on the 4SV. So we all skied on the 3G, which was their giant slalom ski. That's what we chose. And you and I and our guide and Andy Mill, who was the celebrity spokesman for Rossignol in North America at that point, we all headed for the woods at the bottom of the Teen complex. And we had just a great day cutting up the powder, leading down to the river. It was a great day.
It was a fabulous day. The snow was a little heavy. I remember being sopping wet when we came into the little cafe at the end of the morning.
I was teaching at Squaw Valley in those days, and a little wet snow didn't bother me at all.
That adventure on the hill was followed, but we were flown down by a private plane to, wasn't it a beautiful private plane, but it was a private plane, down to Italy so that we could tour what had been the Caber factory and now the Rossignol boot factory. And they were making the first generation of the inverted overlap boot. And I remember our guide to our boot factory tour was George Cooperthwaite, who was now the U.S. distributor for Stokely. It was quite a cast of characters in the media back then, including the inimitable Jeff Rich, who kept trying to torment our host, Jacques Rodet, who was a man unaccustomed to being tormented.
Well, Jeff didn't torment Jacques on purpose. Jeff was a naive. He hadn't traveled much in Europe beforehand. And I remember we were riding on the bus through Paris on the way to dinner, and Jeff looked out the window and said, "What river is that?" And Jacques fixed him with this French gimlet eye stare that would have killed me. But Jeff didn't understand what the Jeff just didn't understand the stupidity of the question.
No, a lot of things glided over Jeff's head on that trip. But it was an amazing trip. We had dinners with seven courses. We had a lunch with so many courses that when we left, they were just bringing out what was going to be a raft of duck. In other words, we hadn't even made it halfway through such a Treviso.
Yeah, the other highlight of that trip to Paris was an evening at the Crazy Horse. For those who don't know, the Crazy Horse is one of the best-known strip clubs in the world.
Very classy strip joints. I mean,
very classy, very classy.
Coat and ties, champagne on the tables, but definitely a strip joint. And it was just part of the whole spare nothing attitude of that Rossignol boondoggle. And there were others. There was the Kesley trip to Steamboat, but there was nothing that could match the scale. Rossi made sure they put themselves out of reach. They didn't want to get Solomon to outdo them at a party. So they made sure that to leave a footprint that nobody else could fill.
Yeah, well, that was the era when Solomon was storming into the ski business after having not quite dominant in bindings, and then they were not quite dominant in boots, and now they were coming into skis with this monocoque system. Were you still there at Solomon when they introduced the ski?
We had just broken ground on a ski factory when I parted ways with Solomon.
Yeah, well, Solomon pulled out all the stops when they introduced the ski, and Rossignol was desperately trying to play catch up. And so they overreached at every opportunity.
Delightfully so. Let's jump track here for a little bit, because you do, career-wise, you make a shift to work at Microsoft doing website development. Talk to me about how that happened, what you did, and how did it end?
Well, I got there through Ski Magazine. I was working at K2 for just a year as product manager there. And K2 was getting ready to sell itself to a company that would close down the Vashon plant and move production to China. So they laid a bunch of us off, very little warning. I think 40 of us had to go because the company was trying to make the bottom line look great. And Ed Petoniak, who was then editor of Ski, jumped on me and said, "Come on back and launch our website." This was in the early days of when the web was just becoming commercial. And it was clear that magazines had to have their own websites. And we were a big magazine company, and Ski was just five issues a year, was the smallest division. And therefore, it was safest to do experimentation at Ski rather than at huge titles like Popular Science and Outdoor Life. So Ski got the assignment, and they decided for some reason that I was the guy who was going to learn about how to build a website. So I went back to work for them, and we launched SkiNet. And it turns out that skiers are open adopters, early adopters. And the website we created grew 20% per week for the first two winters. So a lot of websites were growing fast in those days, but to the company, this looked miraculous. Little did they know that in the long run, it was going to kill off the print magazines. But after 2 years, Microsoft, which was late getting into the internet business, looked around for anyone they could find who had created a commercially successful website, and I was on the short list. So once again, I got a call that changed my life, and a recruiter at Microsoft contacted me and offered me Microsoft stock options, which was something that, bless their hearts, Times Mirror couldn't do. So I jumped ship and went to Microsoft for 3 years, and we built some huge consumer-facing websites. And then Google came along and sort of made our directory business kind of irrelevant. So Microsoft sold our division to Ticketmaster for $350 million. And I didn't want to go to Los Angeles and work for Ticketmaster. I had been working in Denver for Microsoft, which meant that I could still ski. This is the point at which I joined Vail and started teaching there in 1998. I lived off my Microsoft stock options for a little bit until the dot-com crash, at any rate. And then I had to go back to work. That's when I got involved in solar. So here's the thing about solar.
Tell us a little about solar.
You know, the great thing about working for Ski Magazine is I got to travel all over the world and ski all over the world. And everywhere I went, I could see glaciers melting. Every place I went in Europe and New Zealand, you could see that the glaciers were retreating. So I got really interested in climate change, global warming, as we called it in those days, before we got politically correct about things. I wrote my first article on global warming for Ski Magazine in 1989. And when I found myself footloose and fancy free after my IntraWest experience, I went back to school and got a master's degree in environmental journalism, specializing in energy policy. And then I went to work as managing editor of Solar Today magazine for the American Solar Energy Society, because I wanted to do some good work and see what I could do to help ameliorate the climate change that was going to be the death of the sport that I love. And I worked there for 7 years, and eventually they made me executive director of the organization. I got a pretty good business education working in large corporations for Times Mirror and Microsoft and IntraWest and K2 Corp. And I could see, I had a sharp eye for mismanagement. I learned a lot. One of the things I learned at the American Solar Energy Society, working for a nonprofit, is how vulnerable a smallish organization is, even if it's a national scale, is to mismanagement and wrongheaded boards of directors.
I want to talk a little more about your time working with IntraWest, because IntraWest, as you know, is a precursor to the giants of today's ski market, Icon, Conglomerate, and Epic, which is under the Vail Resorts umbrella, as you know. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the current state of ski area ownership in the U.S., but also looking back at your time at IntraWest, how did that in particular inform your future, you know, outlook, if you will, on skiing and where skiing's going?
Well, you know, IntraWest wasn't the first resort conglomerate. Back in the 30s, Fred Pabst of the Pabst Brewing Company established, a dozen or more rope-toe ski areas across the Mid-Atlantic and into the Midwest and up into Vermont, including Big Bromley.
I know, keenly aware.
Right, which was where you grew up.
That's right.
The pattern was repeated later in the 60s and 70s and 80s by the American Ski Company. The ski resort business is weather dependent, capital intensive, and it's a risky business. And if you borrow money for capital improvement, a bad winter is going to kill you. IntraWest had a little bit better handle on things, and they were really a real estate play. But that was a self-limiting enterprise too. When the real estate cratered, so did IntraWest, and it had to go away. You know, IntraWest got really big, and then it got really small, and the remnants were absorbed into Alterra, I guess. Alterra seems to have a much better handle as does Vail Resorts, on where to find the profitability in skiing, and it's in operations, and in particular in cleverly managing your ticket sales cash flow and insulating it from weather issues. If you sell everything up front, you're insulated against bad weather. And that seems to be the successful formula.
It certainly has been. We both had the privilege of working for John Fry, me at Snow Country and you at Skiing Heritage and Skiing History.
Well, before that at Ski, because you remember John was the guy who hired me back in 1974.
Oh, right.
And right. I worked for him until he left Times Mirror and beyond. So John was really my mentor and in a sense, my best cheerleader throughout my career. Every time he had a chance, John offered me a job. As a matter of fact, you owe your tenure at Snow Country to my recommendation. I don't know if you're aware of this, but John offered me that job. And I had just signed a freelance contract with Ski for the next 5 years. And I foolishly told him no. And he said, well, who do you know who could do this job? And I said, well, Jackson Hogan's looking for a job. And the rest is history.
I just wanted to get on the record that John Fry was just an absolutely outstanding human being. And he also nurtured me very graciously because I'm not an easy manage. And he did a terrific job of bringing me along and was always incredibly supportive of my writing and gave me confidence to make it a career. The man was an absolute prince, and not enough recognition really can be laid at his doorstep for so many innovations and so many courageous stands that he took throughout his career. He was a man. We no longer have his like at all.
We do not. We do not.
Let's talk about the current landscape a little, Seth. We've got a completely changed environment. We no longer have editors like John Fry or his rival, if you will, Doug Pfeiffer over at Skiing, another legendary writer. That kind is gone. And what are we left with? A few people are just holding on to a shingle and a address of where to get an AI bot to write their next magazine. Ski, of course, is all, to all intents and purposes, is gone as a print publication.
Yeah.
There's not much left online. So where's our legacy? Well, it's that damn ski net that you started that's gone run amok.
Yeah, the internet has killed off whole categories of print magazines, not all of them. I have to point out that the surviving great magazines, a number of great magazines have survived on the strength of very strong writing and the willingness to subsidize major research in order to produce stunning investigative journalism. So you've got the New Yorker, you've got Vanity Fair, you've got The Atlantic and Harper's. So magazines that are edited for people who love to read have survived, and we're lucky to have them. Magazines that exist primarily just to sell advertising have been less successful. And in particular, magazines that think that they compete with the internet by publishing internet-style reporting, by which I mean bubblegum, stories that last no more than 2 or 3 screen scrolls, have struggled both to sell subscriptions and to sell newsstand copies, and therefore to sell advertising. I think the mistake that most of the ski publishers made when they saw that the audience was fleeing to the internet was to say, well, we need to turn the magazines into bubblegum. And that meant that they devalued writers who were willing to do research, and they weren't as rewarding to read anymore. One of the reasons that Skiing Magazine failed before Ski Magazine did is that at one point, the company that owned both of them, we could talk about how that happened, decided that it didn't make sense for the magazines to compete for the same audience. So Ski Magazine was going to be the upscale magazine for people with disposable income who could afford destination vacations and second homes. And Skiing Magazine was going to be for the young upcoming audience, the 13 to 29-year-olds who wanted to have adventures and experiences and so on and so forth. Well, it turned out that the high demographic readers were readers, and the younger people wanted to look at great pictures. So that audience departed for powder and the internet. and skiing failed. And Ski Magazine was able to soldier on for a while longer, but it's gone now too. I'm delighted to see that Powder is back. And I hope that they can succeed with their print edition. We'll cross our fingers and see.
Speaking of modern horrors, are you already seeing the influence of AI on ski riding or anything that crosses your table?
Not directly at Ski History, but certainly anytime you do a search online, particularly if you're looking for information on products, you're likely to get horrible stuff. Who knows who conglomerates this stuff? A lot of it that reads like it was put together by AI might simply be put together by high school students looking to become internet influencers. It's hard to distinguish between those two genres of creation. Artificial intelligence does not create content. What it does is steal content from a wide variety of random sources, not all of which are factually accurate. Most AI does not have any kind of automated tools to discriminate between fact and bullshit. So you get what you get. When I'm looking for reliable content on what to purchase, I want to read stuff that's written by people who were paid good money by reputable organizations to do the research, test the stuff. So I'd rather read Consumer Reports or New York Times Wirecutter than stuff of unknown provenance. I want to see a brand name, a reputable brand name attached to the service journalism I read. I want to see a reputable brand name attached to any journalism I read. And I read a lot of it. I read the New York Times, or I read The Guardian. I occasionally read Le Monde. I read The Washington Post. I read The Atlantic. I read The Harper's. I read The New Yorker. I read Scientific American. I read a wide variety of stuff where I know for sure that the writers are well paid to spend weeks and months researching a story if necessary, if that's what it takes. And AI is not that.
That's for sure. Before we put a bow on today's proceedings, I want to underscore the importance of the work that you do at Skiing History. And trust me, dear listeners, it is work to get the facts right. We live in an era that Seth has just so eloquently described, when journalism has been hijacked by hucksters to the point where no one can be believed because everyone with a keyboard has already been bought and sold. And in this ocean of lies, Seth's work stands out as an island refuge where the truth is identified, rinsed at the film of innuendo, and celebrated for its unvarnished value. If the world of ski journalism only had a few more Seth Majors and a whole lot fewer phonies, at least skiers would be getting better information. Thanks, Seth, for all that you do for preserving skiing's past and giving voice to our beloved sport's better angels.
Thank you. And I just wanted to thank you for being one of those brand name sources of information. That is, Real Skiers is one of those brand name information sources where the creator does real research and comes up with the real goods.
Oh, thanks, Seth. I appreciate that. And so saying, this has been Jackson Hogan for Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.